Dream of the Red Chamber, Chapter 114.
We are going to trace the specific mechanisms of how an incredibly elite institution, in this case, the Gia family, just unravels.
And we're tracking a very specific compounding failure here. Like, this isn't a sudden explosive demolition, right?
No, not at all.
It is a meticulous, slow-motion diagnostic of institutional rock.
Exactly. So just to orient you within the timeline, we are entering the narrative at a point of, well, absolute crisis.
Yeah. The Gia family has been the apex of the social hierarchy, like a family so wealthy and connected they practically functioned as a regional government.
Wow.
But now, imperial favor has vanished. The estate has been raided. Their assets confiscated by the state.
Just a total disaster.
Right. And the matriarch, Grandmother Gia, has passed away. And Wang Shifeng, who previously acted as the ruthless, highly effective chief operating officer of the domestic sphere, she's on her deathbed.
The compounding failures are just everywhere you look. We have the loss of spiritual and psychological grounding, the collapse of immediate safety nets, the predation of the inner circle, and honestly, the total failure of executive leadership.
The textbook collapse.
It really is. Mm-hmm. And as we work through these stages, I want you to consider the dynamics of your own institutions. When a system starts to fail, whether that's a family, a corporation, or, you know, a society who attempts to hold the line.
Right, and who immediately cashes out.
Exactly. And how much of the ensuing disaster is actually inevitable.
Well, the question of inevitability is precisely where the narrative begins.
Okay, let's get into it.
The text drops us straight into Wang Shifeng's sick room. The servants rush to Jia Baoyu and his wife Xu Bochai in the dead of night.
Right.
And they report that Shifeng is speaking in total delirium.
So the servants note this is happening between the third and fourth watch, right?
Yes, exactly.
So we are in the deepest, most isolated hours of the night. But the content of Shifeng's delirium is what requires real analysis here. She isn't just screaming or speaking nonsense.
No, it's very specific.
Right. She is aggressively demanding a paper boat and a sedan chair. She insists she needs these specific items so she can travel back to Jinling to be recorded in a register or a sezi.
The mechanics of her hallucination are steeped in a very specific cultural understanding of destiny.
Mm-hmm.
In the traditional Chinese cosmological framework, the afterlife and the spiritual realm are not, they're not abstract, ethereal places.
Oh, interesting. So what are they like?
They are highly bureaucratic.
Yeah.
The underworld mirrors the imperial civil service.
Oh, wow. So it's all paperwork down there, too.
Literally. So when Shifeng demands a paper boat, which would typically be burned as a funerary offering to transfer goods to the spirit world.
Right.
And she references these registers. She is anticipating the administrative paperwork of her own death.
Okay, let's unpack this for a second.
Yeah.
She is seeing the ledger of her fate.
Yes.
It's a chilling moment because it strips away the poetry of death and replaces it with cold administration.
Exactly. It's terrifying in a very mundane way.
When Baiyu hears this report from the servants, his initial reaction is pure confusion. He wonders why on earth Shifeng would be traveling back to Jinling, their ancestral home, in her current state.
Right. But then his maid, Jirin, leans in and reminds him of a profound mystical dream he experienced years prior.
Oh, the dream.
Yeah. Jirin jogs his memory about his journey to the Land of Illusion, where he was actually permitted to view the registers of fate for the women in his life.
Right. These registers were literal books, weren't they?
Yes, categorized by the status of the women, containing cryptic poems forecasting their tragic ends.
That's so heavy.
It is. And Jirin reminds him that Shifeng's return to Jinling was explicitly documented in those ledgers.
The moment Jirin mentions the dream, Baiyu's entire worldview shifts. The realization hits him that human existence might be governed by a fixed number, like a predetermined fate that has already been written down, filed, and stamped by the cosmic bureaucracy.
And his subsequent reaction is highly revealing of his character.
Oh, absolutely. He immediately laments his own lack of memory. He wishes he possessed the power of absolute foresight so he could simply know everyone's destiny.
Right, just to save himself the agonizing trouble of worrying about their futures. He vocalizes a desire for omniscience.
Which is such a massive leap.
It is. He states that if he could foresee it all, he wouldn't have to blindly suffer on their behalf.
Mm-hmm.
This is a profound philosophical pivot. Baoyu is faced with the imminent death of a family member and the collapse of his entire material world.
And his psychological defense mechanism is to retreat into fatalism.
Exactly. Just complete surrender.
Oh, wait. Is Baoyu just looking for an easy out here? Like, we need to scrutinize that fatalism because it functions as an incredibly convenient escape hatch, doesn't it?
100%. If the Jia family's ruin is simply a matter of cosmic accounting...
Right.
If the ledgers in Jinling have already dictated the collapse, then Baoyu is absolved of any practical responsibility.
Exactly. He doesn't have to concern himself with auditing the estate's finances or securing their remaining assets if the ship was categorically destined to sink from the moment it was built.
Fatalism provides immense comfort to the powerless, but it also provides an alibi for the passive.
Oof, that's a great way to put it.
I mean, if destiny is a fixed track, human agency is an illusion. You cannot be blamed for a train crash if you were never allowed to touch the brakes.
Right. Which brings us to Bao Chai. This is precisely why the narrative immediately introduces a counterforce to Bao Yu's existential surrender.
Bao Yu gets caught by Bao Chai, and to deflect from the morbid gossip, his mind latches onto an incident from the previous year.
He remembers a fortune-telling stick, right?
Yes. A stick that Bao Chai had interpreted. The crucial detail here is that her interpretation of that stick actually came true regarding Fang sister's grim fate.
Oh, wow. So he thinks she's magic.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
So in this moment of immense panic and uncertainty, Bao Yu's eyes light up. He points at Bao Chai, practically anointing her as a prophet, and begs her to tell him his own future.
He is drowning in the collapse of his family, violently grasping for a lifeline of certainty. He wants the universe, through Bao Chai, to just hand him a roadmap.
Yeah, he wants an easy answer. What's fascinating here is Bao Kai's immediate, fierce rationality. She refuses to take that bait, even with the allure of power dangling right in front of her.
She completely shuts him down.
She does. She explains, with cold precision, that she was not seeing the future. She was quite literally just interpreting the vocabulary written on the wooden stick.
Oh, so she just understood the words better.
Yeah. She recognizes that playing the oracle is a trap. If you convince people you have magical answers, you become responsible for their salvation. Right. So she opts to give him a harsh vocabulary lesson rather than feed his supernatural fantasy.
She is forcefully cutting off his escape route into magical thinking. And she uses a very pointed recent story about another relative to systematically dismantle his delusion.
It's a great example she brings up.
Yeah. She reminds Baiyu of a time when he lost his precious jade, which is a highly symbolic artifact in the family.
Very important piece of jewelry.
Right. So in a total panic, Xing's sister, the younger cousin, went to a woman in their circle named Miaoyu, who claimed to be a mystic. Xing's sister asks Miaoyu to use a planchette to find it.
For those unfamiliar, a planchette in this context is essentially a tool for spirit writing.
Like a Ouija board.
Yeah, it's an ancient divination method, similar to a Ouija board, where spirits are supposed to guide the instrument to write out divine messages.
Okay, that makes sense.
The cultural context here is vital, though. In their society, when rational avenues fail, like finding a lost heirloom turning to divination, was a legitimate, heavily relied upon crutch. The expectation was literal divine intervention.
But it didn't work out that way, did it?
Not at all. The result of this supposed prophet's spirit writing was absolute gibberish. It was a chaotic mess of characters that nobody could decipher. Yet Xing's sister took this nonsensical result and still went around praising Miaoyu as a profound prophet who understood the deep secrets of the universe.
People will just bend over backwards to believe in the magic they want to see, even when the evidence presented to them is literally nonsense.
Exactly.
They would rather worship a confusing puzzle than admit they are entirely helpless.
The psychology of it is devastating. But Bao Chai doesn't just point out the absurdity, she points out the ultimate tragic irony. Miaoyu recently suffered a massive catastrophic disaster of her own. Her life fell apart.
Oh, wow.
Bao Chai uses this to shatter Baoyu's delusion entirely.
Yeah.
She asks the obvious question. If this woman is a mystic who can read the fabric of the universe, why didn't she see her own ruin coming?
Why didn't she step out of the way of her own disaster?
Exactly. Bao Chai freely admits to Baoyu that she has absolutely no idea what her own future holds. She rejects this supernatural escapism because she realizes how lethal it is.
When the foundation of your world is crapping, closing your eyes and playing to a spirit board will simply ensure you are crushed by the falling ceiling.
Yes. She chooses to embrace the terrifying cold truth that life is fundamentally unpredictable.
It is incredibly telling, though, that while Baoyu is practically begging for a magical escape hatch, he is completely ignoring the fact that his own family just executed a highly practical, real-life rescue mission right under his nose.
He totally misses it.
Because Baochai gives absolutely zero oxygen to his mystical fantasy, Baoyu pivots to a gritty, practical reality he had somehow forgotten in the chaos. He asks about a recent family wedding.
The wedding between Jing's sister and Zhu brother.
Right. Baoyu notes that this wedding was done incredibly hastily. It was rushed, hidden away. They didn't invite friends. They didn't invite the sprawling network of relatives.
It was very secretive.
Looking at this from the outside, wouldn't a wedding be the absolute perfect excuse to throw a huge party, rally the fractured family, and boost morale during such a dark time?
You'd think it would be a bright spot.
Yeah, why hide one of the only positive events happening in the estate?
Well, under the normal rules of their aristocratic society, a wedding is the ultimate display of status, wealth, and alliances. You would absolutely use it to flex your social muscle.
So why didn't they?
Because the strict rules of their culture are crashing into the grim reality of their decline. Baochai lists the stark reasons for this quiet wedding, and honestly, it reads like an autopsy report of a dying dynasty.
That is a harsh comparison, but it makes sense.
First, the sprawling network is gone. There are no proper people left to invite. Second, the larger family is actively mourning the old matriarch's passing.
And that's a big deal in this culture, right?
A huge deal. In imperial Chinese culture, the mourning period for a senior matriarch is governed by intense, rigid laws.
So no parties allowed.
Right. Throwing a lavish celebratory party with music and banquets wouldn't just be considered tacky. It would be a severe violation of filial piety, a massive political scandal, and could literally invite further punishment from the government.
The reality check gets even harsher as Baochai continues. The groom's own brother is currently sitting in a prison cell. Furthermore, the family's property was recently confiscated by the state.
It's just wave after wave of bad news.
We really have to understand the mechanics of this ruin. Having a family member in prison isn't just a personal tragedy. It is a systemic financial drain.
Because of the corruption and bribes.
Exactly. The family on the outside is left scrambling to pay massive bribes and daily upkeep costs just to keep the imprisoned relative alive. They are legally entangled, socially radioactive, and completely broke.
It is a staggering amount of pressure. They bypass all the aristocratic pageantry because throwing a party is impossible when you are the target of the state.
But there's another reason for the rush, isn't there?
Yeah, the text reveals another deeply personal, immediate catalyst for this hasty marriage. The bride, Xing's sister, was suffering terrible, harsh treatment from an abusive aunt, the first madam, within the estate.
That's awful.
She was trapped in a cruel, toxic environment with no leverage and no protector.
To extract the bride from that abusive household before the situation escalated further.
Right. They didn't have time for invitations or catering. The house was practically on fire, and they just needed to get the victim out the door.
It is absolute triage. You are looking at a marriage born out of tragedy, surrounded by confiscated property, shadowed by a brother-in-law in a jail cell, and rushed purely to escape domestic abuse.
When you analyze the raw ingredients of this new household, it looks like a recipe for absolute disaster.
Good.
You have deeply traumatized people thrust together under immense financial, social, and political strain. The natural assumption is that this new marriage must be miserable.
Here's where it gets really interesting. The source text reveals the exact opposite outcome. We move from this chaotic, traumatic setup into a surprising, almost shocking new stability.
It's completely counterintuitive.
Baochai tells Baoyu that the new sister-in-law is incredibly filial. In fact, she treats Baochai's mother better than a blood relative would.
We cannot overstate the significance of that detail. In a society where filial piety, the profound respect and duty toward one's parents and elders, is the absolute bedrock of human virtue, saying an in-law treats a mother better than her own flesh and blood is the highest possible compliment.
Wow, so she really stepped up.
She did. It signifies a profound, genuine devotion that transcends formal obligation.
And the harmony extends further. The bride gets along perfectly with Shangling, another member of the household, and she lives peacefully with her new husband.
Which is amazing given his stress levels.
Right. Keep in mind the mechanics of their daily life. This peace is flourishing while the husband, Zhu brother, is constantly out running around the city, desperately scraping together money and collecting debts just to pay for his brother's prison expenses.
The daily grinding stress he is under must be immense.
Yet, despite being vastly poorer, despite the legal nightmares, Bao Chai's mother is actually described as being more at ease now than she was in the grand estate.
That is just wild.
It's like a modern family losing their giant multi-million dollar mansion, being forced to move into a cramped two-bedroom apartment, and suddenly realizing they actually like each other now that the exhausting performative pressure of keeping up appearances is completely gone.
That is a perfect analogy. The contrast between financial poverty and emotional wealth here is staggering. When they lived in the grand estate, they possessed unimaginable wealth. But that wealth was tied to a toxic, highly political environment.
The mansion was essentially a battlefield disguised as a home.
Exactly. You had members of the family, like the abusive first madam, wielding their status to torment those below them. Every interaction was a calculation of power.
You had to constantly watch your back and guard your words.
Precisely. The removal of that toxic estate environment is the catalyst for this unexpected peace. The performative mask of the aristocracy has been violently stripped away by the state confiscations and the imprisonment.
So they have nothing left to hide behind.
Right. They are stripped of their wealth and living under the heavy shadow of debt. But paradoxically, the absence of the estate's politics allows raw, authentic human connections to finally flourish.
That's beautiful in a tragic way.
It is. They are forced to rely entirely on each other. And it turns out, in this concentrated family unit, those genuine connections are remarkably strong. They found stability not in the architecture of the grand house, but in how they treat each other when the money is gone.
Which leads directly into the final massive decision the Su family makes. Because they have cultivated this newfound peace and functionality within their downsized reality, they reach a deeply pragmatic, somewhat shocking conclusion.
It's time to leave the larger estate entirely.
Yes, they are going to cut the cord. Bao Chai casually mentions to Bayou that they have pawned several houses in the city.
They sold off pieces of their legacy just to survive.
But they deliberately kept one small house, and they are planning to pack up and move into it. Think about the gravity of that action. Pawning off real estate to secure a single modest roof over your head is the starkest possible indicator of their social decline.
It is the ultimate severing of ties with the illusion of the old world. They are voluntarily stepping out of the protective, albeit crumbling, bubble of the grand family.
And Bayou's reaction to this news perfectly illustrates the tragedy of his character.
Oh, he just doesn't get it at all.
If we really look at Bayou's mindset in this exchange, we see a person who is completely paralyzed by his dependence on the old system.
He is baffled by the idea of moving.
He literally asks Bao Chai why they would go through the trouble of leaving when staying right there at the grand estate is so much more convenient.
Convenient. Can you believe that?
He complains that if they move into the city, visiting them will take a whole day. He is standing in the ashes of his family's legacy, and he is worried about the commute time for a social visit.
It's absurd.
He assumes this massive, luxurious safety net of the grand family will always be there to catch them. He is pathologically blind to the fact that the net has already unraveled.
This raises an important question about the nature of independence versus dependence. Bayou cannot conceive of an existence outside the walls of the estate, even as those walls are actively falling down.
He's trapped in his own privilege.
He represents the tragedy of someone who refuses to adapt to a harsher reality, choosing instead to cling to the ghost of that privilege. Bao Chai, on the other hand, fully adapts.
She is so sharp.
She delivers a devastatingly pragmatic, brilliant final line to try and wake him from his stupor. She looks at Bao Yu and asks, "Who lives at a relative's house for their whole life?"
Boom. It is the ultimate reality check. It completely shatters the illusion of the permanent guest.
It truly is a paradigm shift for their entire social class. Bao Chai is exhibiting incredibly clear-eyed realism. She knows the era of codependence is over.
The grand family cannot save them.
No, the family couldn't even save its own property from being confiscated. True stability now relies entirely on self-sufficiency.
You have to be willing to stand on your own two feet.
Exactly. Even if those feet are standing on the cheap floorboards of a small, pawned-off house in the city, rather than the polished marble of a borrowed palace. And the narrative immediately proves her thesis correct.
Oh, it really does.
The predation of the inner circle begins the very moment Wang Shifeng draws her last breath.
The speed of the predation is horrifying. Wang Shifeng dies, and the immediate crisis falls onto her husband, Jialian.
Mm-hmm.
The text is brutally explicit about the mechanics of his financial ruin.
Yeah, the aristocratic economy they operated within heavily relied on agricultural stipends from their rural estates and the management of vast stores of physical goods.
But the raids confiscated the reserves, and the estates are failing. Jialin doesn't just lack the funds for a grand funeral. He lacks the daily operating cash to manage the household's immediate needs.
And you have to understand, funerals in this society were not just private moments of grief.
Right.
They were massive, highly visible displays of social capital. The opulence of the funeral directly correlated to the surviving family's ongoing political and social viability.
So a cheap funeral is basically social suicide.
Exactly. Jialin is paralyzed because he understands that a cheap funeral for a woman of Shifeng's previous stature will signal to the entire capital that the Jia family is truly irrevocably broken.
So desperate for a localized infusion of cash, Jialin summons backup. He calls for Wang Ren, who is Wang Xifeng's biological brother.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you would assume the brother of the deceased would provide emotional support or, at the very least, leverage his own network to front the capital for his sister's burial.
You would assume that, yes.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Instead, Wang Ren arrives and immediately begins to audit the funeral preparations. He doesn't offer a single copper coin.
No, not one.
He observes the meager setup and begins to complain loudly, demanding prestige.
Right. He argues that his sister exhausted herself managing the Jia household for years and that she deserves a send-off commensurate with her labor.
He is demanding that the Jia family manufacture wealth that he knows full well they no longer control.
It's an incredible display of toxic entitlement.
It's like the predatory relative who only shows up at the reading of a will, angry that the inheritance isn't bigger. He demands prestige but refuses to pay for it.
Exactly. And when Jialin essentially ignores him, knowing Wang Ren is operating in bad faith, Wang Ren pivots his strategy.
And this is where it gets really dark.
It does. He turns his attention to a highly vulnerable target.
Hmm.
His own niece, Qiaoji, Shifeng's young daughter.
The interaction between Wang Ren and Qiaoji exposes the absolute moral bankruptcy of the high aristocracy in the face of resource scarcity. Wang Ren pulls the grieving child aside and begins a campaign of emotional manipulation.
He implies that Jialin's failure to spend money means he doesn't respect Xifeng's memory. He attempts to weaponize the child's grief against her own father to force spending.
It's just evil. But Qiaoji tries to defend Jialin. She explains the reality. Her father wishes he could afford a proper ceremony, but the capital simply doesn't exist anymore.
And this is where Wang Ren reveals his true motive. He instantly accuses this young girl of hoarding wealth.
Unbelievable.
He claims she still has plenty of assets. When Qiaoji reminds him of the brutal reality of the imperial confiscations from the previous year, Wang Ren flatly refuses to believe it.
To understand Wang Ren's accusation, we really have to look at the mechanics of the dowry system and aristocratic wealth hoarding, right?
Yes, absolutely. Women in these households often maintain private caches of wealth jewelry, gold, silver, separate from the central family accounts, precisely as a hedge against the kind of disaster currently unfolding.
So Wang Ren suspects that Shifeng, being the shrewd manager she was, successfully hid a massive fortune from the imperial auditors.
And from the Jia family matriarchs, intending to save it for Kyoji's future dowry.
Wow. So he looks at his orphan niece and doesn't see a grieving child. He sees an offshore bank account that refuses to give him the access codes.
That is exactly what he sees. The text provides Wang Ren's internal monologue, revealing his absolute certainty that a secret fortune exists.
Mm-hmm.
He makes a conscious, vindictive decision to resent Qiaoji from that moment forward, simply because she isn't a viable revenue stream for him to extract.
The biological tie means absolutely nothing without a financial incentive. The highborn relative acts entirely as a parasitic element.
Right, but the source material provides a stunning structural contrast to Wang Ren's predation.
Enter Pinger.
Yes. While the blood relative attempts to squeeze a child for non-existent funds, a character from the absolute margins of the family hierarchy steps in to provide actual salvation.
Pinger's position in the household is incredibly complex. She is a maid, but also a concubine to Jialin, and was previously Shifeng's most trusted confidant and proxy.
Right. She occupies a lower status role, highly vulnerable to the whims of the masters.
Yet Pinger sees the administrative paralysis. She recognizes that Wang Ren is useless and cruel, and that Jialin is out of options.
So Pinger quietly pulls Jialin aside and offers a localized economic bailout.
A bailout from a maid.
Yes. She produces her own personal belongings, valuable items she managed to successfully hide and preserve during the government raids.
That's incredibly risky for her to even reveal she has those.
Exactly. And she instructs Jialin to take her assets, enter the pawn shop economy, and liquidate them to generate the immediate cash flow needed to dignify the funeral.
When Jilian promises to repay her, Pinger dismisses the idea entirely. She states that the items were originally given to her by Shifeng anyway, so there is no debt to repay.
Her only concern is preserving the dignity of the event. The mechanics of what she is doing are profound.
Right. She is taking her only personal safety net, the physical assets that could keep her from starvation if the family dissolves entirely, mm-hmm. and sacrificing them to maintain the social standing of the family that technically owns her.
It is a masterful subversion of class expectations.
Oh.
The narrative is explicitly arguing that moral character and nobility are completely decoupled from social rank and biological pedigree.
Oh, completely.
The aristocrat operates on suspicion and extraction. The servant operates on grace, loyalty, and a genuine understanding of duty.
It really makes you evaluate your own network. You know, when the infrastructure collapses, the people holding the fancy titles and the blood connections are often the first to attempt to cannibalize the remains.
Yeah, that happens a lot.
The actual structural support frequently comes from the people operating in the trenches, the ones who understand the mechanics of survival and possess a quiet, unheralded loyalty.
However, we must analyze the scale of Pinger's intervention.
Right.
Liquidating a few hidden hairpins and bracelets provides a temporary influx of cash. It buys them a few days of dignity.
But a pawn shop economy cannot sustain an aristocratic infrastructure. Her sacrifice is noble, but it is a microscopic bandage on a massive systemic arterial bleed.
Which transitions us perfectly into step four of the collapse, the total failure of executive leadership.
Because while Jilian is scrambling in the domestic sphere for pawn shop cash to bury his wife, the patriarch of the entire Jia clan, Jia Zheng, is sitting in his outer study.
Yes, and he's receiving a forensic audit of the macro collapse.
The shift in perspective from the domestic funeral to the administrative outer study is crucial. Jia Zheng is meeting with a man named Cheng Rixing.
Now, Cheng Rixing's role is vital to understand. He was one of the last remaining guest scholars or retainers.
Right. Historically, powerful families kept a retinue of educated men on retainer to act as advisors, secretaries, and administrative aides, right?
Exactly. But as the family's wealth evaporated, the vast majority of these retainers abandoned the estate. Cheng Rixing is one of the very few who stayed.
So Jia Zheng is complaining to Cheng Rixing about their circumstances. He laments their bad luck, the recent deaths, and the chaotic state of the estate's management.
He is essentially playing the victim of circumstance.
Totally. But Cheng Rixing refuses to coddle him. He delivers an unvarnished, brutal diagnostic of the estate's internal economy.
He targets the specific mechanics of the embezzlement occurring right under Jia Zheng's nose.
Wait, embezzlement?
Yes. He informs the patriarch that every single manager and servant is actively lining their own pockets.
Oh.
The mechanism of the theft is relentless. Incremental extraction. Cheng explains that year after year, the staff simply take estate property back to their own homes.
It's death by a thousand cuts. The overhead of the estate is massive, but the actual assets are being steadily siphoned out the back door by the very people paid to guard them.
Right. And Cheng Rixing points out that the family is bleeding cash, not just from the theft itself, but from the massive legal fees incurred trying to chase down the stolen goods in a corrupt judicial system.
It's just a financial nightmare.
It gets worse. Then Cheng Rixing brings up the most glaring symbol of their ruin, the Grandview Garden.
Oh, the garden. This garden was the crown jewel of the Jia family, a massive, hyper-expensive landscaping and architectural marvel built specifically to host a visiting imperial concubine.
Right, it was the physical manifestation of their peak political power.
But Cheng Rixing points out that the garden is now a massive liability. It has become an abandoned, overgrown wasteland.
The family cannot find a buyer to liquidate the asset. But more critically, the staff refuses to enter the grounds.
Why?
They claim the garden is infested with ghosts and spirits.
Okay, and this is where Cheng Rixing's audit becomes truly brilliant. He demystifies the supernatural entirely.
Yes, he does.
He explicitly tells Jia Zheng that the ghosts are an operational cover story. The servants themselves are orchestrating these rumors, playing tricks in the night to terrify the rest of the household.
It is an ingenuity born of corruption. By establishing a narrative that the garden is haunted, the corrupt managers create a massive, unmonitored dead zone right in the middle of the estate.
It's so smart, honestly.
It is. The ghosts keep the oversight committees and the honest servants away, allowing the bad actors to strip the garden of its remaining valuables, cutting down rare timber, stealing fixtures, fencing remaining assets in total secrecy.
The supernatural is just camouflage for an ongoing heist.
Exactly.
So Cheng Rixing clearly outlines the problem, but he also provides a highly logical, actionable solution, right?
He does. He proposes a rapid restructuring.
Right. He advises Jia Zhang to appoint one deeply trusted individual to conduct a ruthless audit of every single department, fire the corrupt managers, retain the honest ones, and fundamentally force the managers responsible for the deficits to pay back the stolen funds from their own pockets, stop the bleed through immediate accountability.
It is standard, sensible crisis management. Audit, consolidate, enforce.
So my question is, why does Jia Zhang instantly and categorically reject this plan? Is he just lazy?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, we are looking at the fatal flaw of his executive style. It is not mere laziness.
Okay, what is it then?
It is an obsession with the aesthetics of traditional Confucian leadership at the expense of its practical application.
He dismisses Cheng Rixing, claiming, you don't understand. He offers a litany of excuses.
Right.
He says he cannot trust anyone to do the audit, not even his own nephews. He claims his current state of mourning prevents him from taking aggressive action.
He even falls back on self-deprecation, claiming he has never possessed the talent for household management anyway.
We could categorize his behavior as toxic passivity, masquerading as moral superiority. Jia Zhang cares far more about his PR than his P&L.
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
He explicitly tells Cheng Rixing that since his grandfather's era, the family brand has been built on benevolence and generosity.
Mm-hmm.
He states he has never been a harsh master, and he refuses to start acting like a tyrant now just to save some money, fearing the social ridicule it might bring.
He is prioritizing the optical illusion of magnanimity over his fundamental duty to protect the institution.
Right. In the Confucian framework, the patriarch is responsible for the order and survival of the family. By refusing to be harsh, which in this specific context simply means holding thieves accountable for their crimes.
Right, just basic accountability.
Jia Zhang is actively facilitating the destruction of his own lineage.
He utilizes his grief, his supposed kindness, and his admitted incompetence as highly effective shields against the difficult, unpopular labor of executive decision-making.
It's incredibly frustrating to read.
And it's incredibly common, too. We've all seen this in modern workplaces or communities.
Oh, definitely.
Think of the CEO, the board president, or the community leader who absolutely refuses to fire a highly toxic employee or refuses to initiate a forensic audit of missing funds, all under the guise of maintaining a positive culture or trusting the team.
Right. The leader gets to preserve their self-image as the nice guy, while the organization slowly bleeds to death, the honest employees burn out, and the bad actors eventually hollow out the entire structure.
Jia Zhang's benevolence is, in reality, a profound moral cowardice.
That's exactly what it is. And Cheng Rixing attempts one final warning. He points out the macroeconomic reality.
Right.
He says other incredibly wealthy families might possess the deep reserves necessary to survive this level of systemic theft for a decade, but the Jia family's reserves are gone. They cannot survive the year.
But Jia Zhang simply deflects. The audit fails not because the data is wrong, but because the executive lacks the fortitude to act on it. The rot is fully systemic, top-down and bottom-up.
And it is precisely at this moment of total paralysis, as the Jia family sinks under the weight of its own mismanagement, that the narrative introduces the final stage of our anatomy of a collapse.
Step 5. A visitor arrives at the estate gates, representing a trajectory moving in the exact opposite direction.
Yes. The servants announce the arrival of Xin Ying Jia.
Okay, the historical and geopolitical context of the Xin family is essential to understanding this final act.
It really is. The Xins are an aristocratic family from the south, Jinling, the very place Xi Feng was hallucinating about. They are old allies of the Jias, but their recent history serves as a chilling prequel to the Jia family's current nightmare.
Because years earlier, the Xin family suffered a catastrophic fall from grace.
Right. They were targeted by the emperor, stripped of their noble titles, and their vast wealth was confiscated.
They experienced the exact same imperial raid the Jias are experiencing right now.
Exactly the same.
But Xin Ying Jia is not arriving to commiserate about their shared poverty. He is arriving to announce a spectacular political rehabilitation.
The imperial winds have shifted. Xin Ying Jia reveals that the emperor has suddenly restored him to favor. His titles have been returned. His properties are being restored.
And he has been assigned a massive, highly critical military and political objective.
Yes, the Empire is currently fighting a war against coastal pirates in the south, and Zanin Jia has been appointed to suppress them.
The intrusion of this macro-political reality into the domestic tragedy of the Jia family is incredibly jarring.
It is.
I mean, we have spent this entire deep dive examining the microeconomics of pawn jewelry and haunted gardens, and suddenly the narrative pulls back to reveal imperial decrees and massive coastal warfare.
It forces the reader to recognize the extreme fragility of the elite class. Their entire existence is predicated on the volatile whims of imperial favor.
And this geopolitical instability is actively severing their micro-level family ties. During the visit, Jia Zhang asks Zhenyin Jia for a crucial favor.
Right.
Jia Zhang's daughter is married to a local military commander stationed down in that pirate-infested region.
And because of the ongoing war and the disruption of communication lines, the Jia family has completely lost contact with her.
The empire's instability is literally tearing the family apart geographically.
It is. But the geopolitical machinations, as fascinating as they are, serve primarily as the backdrop for the absolute climax of this encounter.
Yes. So as Zhenying Jia prepares to leave the estate, he accidentally crosses paths with Jia Bayu, and the reaction is instantaneous. Zhenying Jia stops dead in his tracks, completely stunned.
Because Zhenying Jia has a son of his own, also named Baoyu Zhen Baoyu.
Okay.
And upon seeing Jia Baoyu, Zhenying Jia realizes they don't just share a name. He states that Jia Baoyu is an exact, flawless physical replica of his own son.
Wait, really? Like, identical?
Yes. He observes that not only are their facial features identical, but their micro-expressions, their mannerisms, their entire physical presence is duplicated.
Wow! We are suddenly thrust into the literary and psychological territory of the doppelganger.
Yes, we are.
To understand the mechanism here, we have to look at the philosophical duality the author, Cao Suiken, embedded in the novel's foundation. The concept of Zen versus Jia.
It is the core linguistic pun of the entire narrative. The surname Jia is a homophone for false or fictitious.
Right.
And the surname Zen is a homophone for true or real. You have two families, the true and the false, acting as structural mirrors.
So the Zen family plummeted into ruin, hit the bottom, and is now rapidly ascending back to the apex of imperial power. While the Jia family reached the absolute apex and is now rapidly plummeting into terminal ruin.
It's an elevator system of fate. As one car goes up, the other must go down. And standing at the exact center of each family is an identical boy named Baoyu.
So we have to ask, what does this all mean? Is Zhen Baoyu a warning? Is he a parallel universe manifestation of who Jia Baoyu might be if the circumstances, the true circumstances, were different?
He represents the inescapable cyclical nature of rise and fall. But how Jia Baoyu reacts to the existence of his literal mirror image is the final, definitive diagnostic of his character.
Because he does not view this doppelganger as a profound philosophical warning or a moment for introspection at all.
No, not even slightly. He is simply thrilled by the novelty of it.
He practically sprints back to the inner chambers to tell his wife, Bao Chai, the news. He explains that this identical Zhen Baoyu will be arriving in the capital soon.
And his immediate proposal for how to handle this event is just staggering in its immaturity.
It really is. He tells Bao Chai that when this stranger arrives, all the women of the inner household must go out and look at him to verify if the resemblance is truly exact.
He treats the manifestation of his own doppelganger as a circus attraction, a fun diversion for the family to gawk at.
He entirely misses the ominous structural implications of the Zen family's rise.
Completely misses it.
Yeah.
And Bao Chai's reaction to his proposal is swift, sharp, and totally uncompromising.
She shuts him down immediately. She demands to know why he's speaking so carelessly.
Right.
She points out the absolute absurdity of him suggesting that the sequestered women of the household should parade out to stare at a strange man simply because he shares Baoyu's face.
Her reprimand is not just about prudishness, though. It is about defending the final remaining bastion of their identity.
Exactly. The estate's finances are utterly destroyed. The political protection is gone. They are pawning their possessions to bury their dead.
Mm.
But Bao Chai remains fiercely, relentlessly protective of their social propriety and the strict gender boundaries of their aristocratic class.
She is holding the line. She is reminding Baoyu that the rules of their society, the structures of decorum, haven't simply vanished just because their bank accounts have been zeroed out.
Right. A strange man is still a strange man, regardless of an identical face.
Propriety is the absolute last structural wall she has left to defend, and she will not let Bayou tear it down for a moment of novelty.
It reveals what individuals cling to when the material world falls away. For Bao Chai, adherence to the rules is her final mechanism of control in an uncontrollable collapse.
Yes.
Oh.